Voilà 20 ans qu'à Academ, nous parlons de judaïsme sous toutes ses coutures. Et voici qu'un des plus éminents chercheurs en études juives, qui a passé sa vie à explorer le labyrinthe des textes de notre tradition, nous révèle que le concept même de judaïsme n'est pas vraiment juif. Dans un livre publié aux éditions du CERF, Daniel Boyarin démontre que la notion même de judaïsme serait en fait une fabrication chrétienne que les juifs n'ont adoptée que très tardivement avec l'irruption de la modernité. Cela nous bouscule forcément et nous avons aujourd'hui le privilège de pouvoir en discuter avec l'auteur Daniel Boyarin. Welcome to Academ.
Thank you. Thank you.
And shalom aleichem.
Aleichem shalom.
It's the first time we can interview you on Academ. Before we start talking about the content of this book, you are used to say that in every book you are correcting your other books.
Right.
This book was, you wrote that book 10 years ago.
Yes.
It took some time to get translated into French.
Yes.
Are you still the same person that the one
who
wrote that book?
I'm still the same person, only more so, with some correction.
Okay.
As you know, David Lemler has written a wonderful, wonderful parallel book, which he wrote in French, of course, and I am helping to get it translated into English. I think it's a very important book. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm helping in a very small way, but he has shown me that some developments that I consider to be only modern were beginning earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we see the nitzanim, the little shoots, or at any rate, the roots of in, for instance, in Yehuda HaLevi, in the Kuzari, in one place in the Kuzari, and it's an anomaly there, but it's a very interesting anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
When the Kuzari is talking about the Shema, Kriyat Shema, he describes it as the Jew is one who confesses in the Shema to this belief and belief and belief, and that this is the essence of Yahaduya.
Yahaduya?
Yeah, I mean, I'm taking the Arabic, and sorry.
Uh-huh.
But... And which means Judaite,
right?
But it's so contradictory with everything else that Yehuda HaLevi says. Mm. So and what's interesting is the translators, the Ibn Tibbon, you know, the Kuzari was written in Arabic, of course, and it was very quickly translated into Hebrew within, I think, half a century by Ibn Tibbon, Yehuda Ibn Tibbon. And he translates there this word that means Yahadut or Judaite. He translated as the Yehudim, the Jews.
Oh, the people.
The people. So even he does not, in the same time as Yehuda HaLevi, he says the people. He doesn't say the abstraction, the Judaism. So it begins then. That is the correction that I would say.
So you say there was nothing like Judaism. Jews didn't know the concept of Judaism. So
right.
What does that mean?
It means that they didn't have an abstraction that could be separated from the people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is possible now to write a whole book about Judaism and not talk about Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but it was not possible in antiquity, because if you had to write a book about Judaism, there's no such thing. There's no such abstraction. If you want to write a book about Jews, you write about Jews. You might write about what they believe, what they do, how they eat, how they have sex.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
how they're acting.
How they are acting, and what they are saying also. Mm-hmm. But speaking is also praxis, right?
Right.
It's verbal praxis, but it's praxis.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have some object, some abstract object that you can say, Judaism, point one, Judaism, point two. You know, I'm just giving an example of...
But maybe this was just a time or a world where people didn't think with concepts at all.
Well, it would be a serious mistake to think that people didn't think with concepts after Plato and Aristotle and, you know. But there were certain kinds of concepts that were spoken and other kinds of concepts that are not. Listen, I'm here in Paris, so I can invoke some names. I'll start by invoking the name Lucien Febvre, who gave us, in his brilliant book about Rabelais, The Religion of Rabelais, he says, the idea of the mentalité, things that can be said and things that can't be said, not because they are forbidden to being said, but because they can't be imagined in a particular time, right? So the notion, first of all, even of a religion as separate from an entire world of the culture of the of a people, was not a. You know, I just give an example. Pontifex. In Latin. Now it means the Pope. And then it meant the high priest of Rome. But he was also the one who collected the taxes and fixed, took care of the roads and the Cloaca Maxima. So there isn't the kind of division that we make between politics, law, religion.
And this division is modern.
And this division is modern.
So there wasn't even a concept of religion, actually.
There wasn't a concept of religion, and there wasn't... yeah, exactly. So this was... the Christians really invented the concept of religion.
So that's why what I wanted to ask you. Why is Christianism a religion and not Judaism?
Because... Christianism explicitly separates the people, the ethnos, the ethnic group, from a separate sphere.
From the belief?
Belief, yeah, from belief. Tertullian, in the third century already, says, we are the first... collective, I use the modern term, in the world that takes from all of the people and makes of them something new that is defined by faith.
Which is what Paulus already says, that there's no Greek and no Jews?
Paulus is getting there. He's beginning. But by the third century, this is the... explicit and developed claim of, we have other predecessors. I don't have to wait for Tertullian. Ignatz of Antioch, Ignatius.
So they're making of Christianism a religion. Right. They're inventing the religion.
Exactly, because he says, better a Jew who speaks Christianism than a Christian who speaks Judaism, right? This is very, very interesting. So already we have two kinds of discourses that are separated from, so a person can be a Jew and speak Christianism or be a Christian and speak Judaism, which is impossible earlier.
Right? So that's also the moment where they begin to talk about Judaism?
The Christians begin to speak about Judaism. In order to have a religion, they have to have an anti-religion, right? You know, you can't have a binary with only one thing. There have to be two.
But we had Purim not a long time ago.
Yes.
At the end of the book of the Megillat Esther, One can read that there were a lot of people that were mityahadim.
Yes.
What does that mean?
How do you translate mityahadim?
They were becoming Jewish.
No.
So?
They were acting like Jews.
What does that mean? What were they doing?
They were putting on tefillin, and they were eating kosher, and they were keeping Shabbos.
They were eating gefilte fish?
And that depends. Either chaimi or gefilte fish, depending whether they were Ashkenazi Persians or Sephardi Persians. And the real question is whether they put sugar in the gefilte fish.
Right? So they were acting like Jews?
They were acting like Jews. This... we still have this word, this usage in Hebrew. What are mista'aravim?
Right.
People who, soldiers, Jewish Israeli soldiers who pretend to be Arabs.
They're disguising.
They disguise themselves as Arabs. Mm-hmm. So these Persians, when they saw that the Jews were given permission by Ahasuerus,
to defend themselves.
Not only to defend themselves,
to attack. Right.
They pretended to be Jews so that they would
to be on the good side.
To be on the good side.
So they were not becoming Jews.
No.
But there is something like conversion to Judaism, even in the Gemara, in the Talmud.
I am not saying there is no conversion to Judaism.
So what did it mean to Judaism?
It meant to join the people. Mm-hmm. Steve Mason, a scholar, has written very, very beautifully on that. Let's say I was born in Lita and I was Lithuanian. I came to America, and because the rules were more generous than they are now, after a few years, I have an American passport. Now I call myself an American. Mm-hmm. But I might still be speaking Yiddish. I might still be, of course, keeping Shabbos. Mm. I might be writing poetry in Hebrew, but I'm American. So it's a juridical. The idea of conversion to a religion begins in the 4th century. Christians.
With the Christians.
Yes.
I ask you a naive question, but that I'm asking myself since I was a child. Why did Christianism succeed so much and not Yiddishkeit?
Because Constantine became a Christian.
So it's only political?
Not only political, but power. Yes, power. Mm-hmm. Power and domination. Look, there's another reason, I mean, that everybody says. Because it was so much easier to become a Christian than to become a Jew, you know.
Because of the Brit Milah? Because of the absence of Brit Milah?
Brit Milah maybe was a part of it, but also because of a nice terrine de porc. Uh-huh. You know, I mean, there were so many rules, and so it...
The absence of mitzvot, you mean?
Yeah. And but they wouldn't think of it that way. They would think of it as having to undergo a cultural change, to become a Jew. That's exactly the point. To become a Jew, you have to undergo a cultural change. Josephus talks about the Jews wearing funny hats, certain hats, and the people didn't like it. Mm-hmm. So it's not only what we today would call religion, but it's adopting a whole culture. I'll tell you a wonderful story. In my town in Berkeley, there was a very progressive synagogue, politically progressive also, called Kihila. Mm-hmm. Right? So there was a couple there. And they had been together for many years and been coming there. And the husband was Gentile and had not converted. Right? But he used to go to the synagogue with his wife. And it happens he had a beautiful voice. So it came one Rosh Hashanah, and it came to Yom Kippur. Hinani ha'anim emas, right? You know, and which is this beautiful piyut. Right? So they wanted him to sing it. So he finally agreed. They kept persuaded him. This is a true story. And he finally agreed. And he was going up and they wanted him to take a tallit. And he said, no, I'm not going to take a tallit. I'm not Jewish. So he did it absolutely beautifully, of course. And he came down and he said to his wife, his Jewish wife, he said, I'm not going to do that again unless I become a Jew, unless I convert. The following year, they wanted him again because he had done it so beautifully the year before. So this time they persuaded him. He took a tallit and he went and he sang Hinni Ha'ani Mimas. And he came down and his wife said to him, so what do you think of what your people are doing in the Middle East?
You became a Jew.
Right. But the point is, you become a Jew. It doesn't mean you keep Shabbos. It doesn't mean you believe in... it means you take on a whole set of identifications. A whole set of identifications.
That's what we call in German Schicksalsgemeinschaft.
Yeah.
Communauté de destin.
Genau. Mm. Genau. Mm. You know, I'm a Jew all the way down. Something of a dissident Jew. And people sometimes ask me, they said, why am I so focused on Israel?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Why am I so focused on the Middle East?
Mm-hmm.
Terrible things are happening all over the world. Mm-hmm. Why do I? I say, because I'm a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
And a Jew has to be a Zionist.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of Zionist I am is an anti-Zionist. Somebody who's not a Jew can be indifferent.
Mm-hmm.
Can say, I care about what is happening with the Uyghurs in China, the same way I care what is happening with the Palestinians.
Mm.
Now, I care about the Uyghurs, of course.
Mm.
But I am much more involved with what is happening to the Palestinians because I am a Jew.
Let's get to that point that you are considered as a dissident, let's say. It's a big part of your work, too, that you focused on heretics.
Yeah.
On apostas and apikorsim. Apikorsim.
Yeah.
And one of them is Paulus, right?
Yes.
Why is it so interesting to work on these figures of apikorsim?
Partly because they help us articulate the borders. You know, I am very interested in the borders.
Mm-hmm.
And when we see the edges, we have more of a sense of the whole, in a sense. But that's only part of it. I love marginality.
Mm.
I love marginality. I once thought of writing an autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, I didn't, although Clemence helped me to do one, so to speak. And I was going to call it a passion for the margins.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You know, where... where there's a certain kind of chaotic creative energy, no? I sometimes I say, and I hope the French will not be insulted, that Paris is a much more beautiful city than Berlin. But Berlin is a more interesting city because Paris has a kind of polished, finished.
Mm.
Essence of beauty.
Mm-hmm.
It's something beautiful, but Berlin is all still...
Zerquetscht.
Zerquetscht. Exactly. Yeah.
Something broken.
And partly because this combination of a communist and a Western bourgeois city into one, with the different aesthetic sensibilities... You know, socialist realism meets abstract expressionism.
It has more intensity, too.
And it creates a kind of intensity, yeah.
The Jewish people, the Jewish nation, I don't know, is also a marginal...
Exactly.
Belongs to the fact of being Jewish.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Do you consider yourself as a apikoros, as a heretic?
No, I call myself a heterodox Jew.
Heterodox Jew. Something that disturbs a lot of people about you, apart from the Zionist thing, is that I met you on Shul. You had a Shabbos Girtel.
Yeah.
You stand up during...
No, Girtel. I'm a Litvak.
No, a Shabbos Girtel for the key.
Oh, for the key. Oh, absolutely. Okay.
Because of Hotzah.
Yeah. I thought you were accusing me of being a chassid for a minute.
No, I don't. I don't. you're some kind of chassid, but not this one. You're standing up during Torah. You're a practicing Jew, right?
Absolutely.
You're from Jew. Yeah. But you are also a scholar who knows that all these Sifrei Kodesh are human artifacts. What does for a Jew like you mean Torah min ha-shamayim?
Well, I could give you one answer. I could say it means that God chose the Jews to write these books. No. It's a stance. It's a stance. It's a cipher for me of sacrality, right? Of the sacredness of these books, these words. The consequences of that sacrality are a certain way that we treat holy things, right?
Mm-hmm.
But since we don't traditionally claim to know exactly what all those books mean, there is no such thing as a fundamentalist Jew. People use the term fundamentalist to refer to Haredim.
Mm-hmm.
It's wrong.
Why?
Because fundamentalist is a Christian movement, a modern Christian movement, that means that we understand every word of Scripture. And we follow only the absolutely correct, one and only fundamental understanding of Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it is fundamentally the case that when the Torah talks about Korban Pesach, it is referring to the Messiah, it is referring to Yoshka, right? Who is going to be the Korban Pesach. So that's what fundamentalism, it's a kind of literalism that insists that we know...
What the text says.
What the text
means.
Says.
Yeah.
And Rabbinic Judaism, the kind of Yiddishkeit that we all practice, insists that we don't know what the text means. We don't know what the text means. For halachic matters, we come to a consensus simply because it would be too chaotic if what is kosher in one house is not kosher in the next house.
So it's a pragmatic...
It's a kind of pragmatic thing for the sake of... it doesn't matter if what is kosher in Lvov is not kosher in
Casablanca.
In Casablanca, exactly, right? It gets to be a problem when to start getting to be in the same place. But if on 24 Herzl Street they are saying this is kosher, and on 28 Herzl Street they're not, you don't have a community. Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of necessity for halakha, which does not mean that you can believe whatever you want to or that there is a opposition between halakha and agadah, but I'm saying that's a kind of concession to necessity. But we don't say that. And I'll tell you something else. You know, my brother used to daven on East Broadway.
Jonathan,
my brother Jonathan, used to daven on East Broadway in Reb Moshe Feinstein Zatzal's yeshiva there. And he used to go and sit and learn. And there was somebody in the yeshiva, used to come, many people came to sit in the yeshiva. It wasn't like a closed institution. People would just come and sit and learn. So there was one man who used to come and sit and learn every day. And every once in a while, I don't know how often, but every once in a while, he would go to the wall and he would say, I don't do what God wants me to do. I do what I think God wants me to do. Right? Now, the Gemara makes us sure that we don't know what God wants us to do. Because if Rabbi Meir says this, Rabbi Yehuda says that. And if we think we found the proof that Rabbi Yehuda is right and Rabbi Meir is wrong, the Talmud immediately gives us a terutz. What is a kushya in the Talmud? A proof that one of two views is correct. And what is a terutz? The proof that we don't know which is correct. Right? This is essential. This is essential. It's an essential epistemological principle, right?
But would you consider yourself as an atheist?
Better I don't answer that question.
Okay.
I get up in the morning, I wash my hands, I daven, I eat kosher.
No. Let's not talk about religion.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. Well, that's why it's so strange to me that when in German, you say the Yiddish Glaube.
La foi juive.
Exactly. Or the Jewish faith, say in America. Right. Now, it's very interesting. There is, at UC Berkeley, where I teach, there is a fellowship that was donated by somebody 100 years ago, for students of the Jewish faith. Any Jew who applies is eligible to receive this fellowship. They don't have to believe anything. Nobody is asking them whether they submit to the Ikre Emunah of the Rambam, right?
Which is a late invention anyway.
And the Rambam lost. He lost that battle. For defining Jews only as people who have certain articles of faith. So we say it every day. We say, I mean, in certain communities, we say the Ikre Emunah. But nobody really thinks. If you have nine people for a minyan and you need a tenth, and you see a Jew walking by, nobody says, do you believe in the Maimonidean creed before we count you as a minion, right?
Is that also the big difference between Judaism and Christianism?
I think it is one enormous difference. You know, sometimes we think, okay, what's the difference between Judaism and Christianity? Christians believe in the Trinity and Jews don't believe in the Trinity. It's not the case. Christians believe in the Trinity, and Jews don't know anything about the inner structure of God, and we know that we don't know. So it's not that we have different theologies. Christians have theology. Jews don't have theology.
To stay a little bit in the Torah and Midrash world, I know you're working on Midrash right now for your next book.
Yes.
There's one sentence that interests me a lot that you use sometimes, that the Torah is its own commentary. What does that mean?
First of all, the fundamental principle of Midrash is that any word in the Torah is the context for any other word in the Torah. So you can take a word and attach it to a word. You can take a word from, well, why should I say it in my own words? I can say, Ben Azai was sitting in Doresh, making midrash, and fire was burning around him. So Rabbi Acha got concerned. What is going on? He went to Rabbi Akiva. I think it was Rabbi Acha. He went to Rabbi Akiva and he said, Ben Azai is sitting and making midrash and there's fire burning around. Maybe you should come and see what's going on. So Rabbi Akiva comes and says to Ben Azai, I heard that you were making midrash and there was fire burning around. Were you perhaps busy with the inner rooms of the chariot? And Ben Azai says, no, I wasn't. I was taking words from the Chumash, from the Torah, joining them to other words from the Torah, and joining those words to words of the prophets, and then to words of the Ketuvim, Vehadvarim smeichim kiyom netinatam misinai. And the words were, the new words, the new sentences, were as luminous. Sameach is like, or sameach, were as luminous as when they were given at Sinai. And weren't they given with fire at Sinai? So it's not, some people describe Midrash as updating the Torah, making it relevant for, no. It's for reproducing the conditions of revelation. Right? Reproducing the conditions of revelation. So Midrash is new Torah. It's not accidental that we call it Torah, that we call the Gemara Torah. Learning Torah doesn't mean that you're sitting and reading Vayikra, right? Mm. You could be reading a Rabbi Akiva Egger on a Tosfot, which is commenting on Rashi, which is commenting on the Gemara, and that's learning Torah because it is this living textual production, not only reception.
Could one say that Midrash came before Torah? The Torah Shebaal Peh came before Torah Shebichtav?
As a kind of myth or metaphor, yes. Hmm. But
people are speaking before they're writing.
Yeah. Well, Derrida, for Derrida, every speaking is already a writing, so I will avoid that question.
So it's Derrida on Rabbi Akiva Eger on Tosfos.
Right? And Moshe Rabbeinu is watching and doesn't understand.
I asked myself, you've been all your life, adult life, on the Talmud. Why didn't you go your whole life on the yeshiva, actually? Do you sometimes regret to have become an academic and not a yeshiva bocher and a avrech and so on?
Sometimes, yeah. I would have had to give up too much, as attractive as it seemed to me. And I even know which yeshiva I would have.
Which one?
Tells.
Tells. That's where your great-grandfather comes from.
My great-grandfather. My grandfather learned there as a child, and they were, grandfather was very close to Tells his whole life in America.
In Cleveland, right?
In Cleveland, yeah. And I went and I visited there, and that would have been my yeshiva. That would have been Torah returning to its achsanya. Right? So there was something very seductive, very appealing.
So why not?
Partly because I was already married to a woman who would not have come with me, I think, you know. Mm-hmm. Or if she did, she would have been very unhappy. That's a small part of it, and mm-hmm. but that can be taken as a kind of synecdoche, you know, for so many things in my world that. I heard a wonderful story recently. You'll understand the Zustell. There's a Rav Bigman in Israel. He's a Rosh Yeshiva and Yeshivat HaKibbutz HaDati. Big, big Talmid Chacham. He came from America. He grew up in Chicago before he went to live it. He's in Eretz Yisrael for 60 years, 70 years. Now he's not. He's a young man like me. He studied in a yeshiva in Chicago, a small yeshiva. I heard this story recently. And the Rosh Yeshiva was an old Talmid Chacham from Eastern Europe. Every Motzei Shabbos, he would take all the bochrim from the yeshiva to eat ice cream. There was a kosher ice cream place in Chicago. He took them all every Motzei Shabbos to eat ice cream. So finally, one of them had enough chutzpah to say, Kvod HaRav, why do you take us? Is it from Alava Malka? What is this? He said, you should be normalish. Right? Mm-hmm. So while part of me finds that very, very special kind of life, mm-hmm. very appealing, another strong part of me wanted and still wants to be part of the world perhaps a more scattered, mm-hmm. Less intense way, but yeah.
Your parents were religious?
No. No.
So you didn't grow up religious?
No.
Even though there was this grandfather?
Yeah, but my other grandfather was was a Bundist.
So you grew up on a farm, right?
I grew up on a farm in New Jersey.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one grandfather was a Bentera, although he made a living as an insurance agent, but the day he retired from the business, he started going every day to sit in the yeshiva again. It's like he was a telzer einikel, and he left and came to America because he didn't want to be a Rosh Yeshiva, right? But he maintained, and which he would have been, mm-hmm. right? He was in line to be the, but he came and he had a business. He was from his whole life, and then he went back to learning.
That's the father of your mother, right?
That's the father of my mother, and the father of my father was a Bundist. Yeah.
And your parents were still Bundists?
No, they were leftist Americans, but so that's where I got this mishmash.
Right.
Which in my book, The No State Solution, I talk about a kind of amalgam of Haredi and Bund,
right.
as a kind of ideal Yiddishkeit, a kind of ideal Judaite.
There was, in the beginning of Zionism, some kind of movement of... I don't know, it was called Haredi socialist, something.
Yeah, well, yeah.
There were Haredi kibbutzim already.
Of course. Paul Agudat Yisrael. Yeah.
There was some kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so you didn't grow up frum. There weren't even Shomer Shabbos or so at home. So how did you become frum? How did you discover all this? The Torah world.
I have several stories, several versions of the story. Since this is television, I will tell one of the more colorful versions, which is that I went to college And I took LSD. And I realized that bourgeois rationalism did not explain very much of anything. Part two of that is that I was standing in Penn Station, or Grand Central Station, I think it was, in the train station, and I was up on the mezzanine, and I was looking down, and I saw people are going like this, and other people are going like this, and people are going like this, and people like this. Everybody's going in different directions, and I wanted to be going in a straight, and so I had a kind of experience of commitment to emunah, right?
To find your derech.
To find my derech, to find it, yeah. And then by the time, that things started to get complicated again, theoretically, and you know, I wasn't so sure. I was already, you know, I was already on the derech. One time I was in Tel Aviv, and in Jerusalem, and I was at a friend's house, and I was at that time having a religious crisis. Should I stay from or not stay from? And we turned on the television. They turned on the television. We watched the television show that was the only time I saw. It was called Florentine, about a neighborhood in Tel Aviv, and you know, these sort of aimless secular bourgeois type. I said, "What? I'm going to give up Torah for that and stay where I am."
And then you had also masters. You went to study at the Jewish Theological Seminary, and some persons played a very important role for you. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about Chaim Zalman Dimitrovsky? What influence had he on you?
Tremendous. I think to this day he is certainly one of the two people who had the greatest influence on me in my life.
What kind of Jew was he?
First of all, he was a Talmid Chacham Atzum, a giant in Torah. And a modest giant, you know? A very gentle person. He wouldn't let us stand up when he came into the room. Mm-hmm. Because he said, "I don't want that there should be any distance. I want you to be able to ask kashyas, to tell me when you think I'm wrong." And, you know, that kind of... one time they offered him some sort of a prize. And he didn't accept it. So I asked him, we were very close, and I asked him, he said, "You know, COVID is like chazer."
Like pig.
Yeah, like pig, like pork. If I'm going to eat pork in my life, I want it to be very, very special pork. I want it to be...
Not a little hamburger.
Yeah, exactly.
Not McDonald's. Yeah. And the other master for you was Shaul Lieberman, right?
Yeah. First of all, he was, to me, very sweet also. Even he had much more of a reputation for being fierce. I think... I was one of his last. He was I don't know how old, but he was old by the time I, and I was one of his last, the last generations. So I think he was not as fierce as he had been. But I learned I think almost most of what I do in scholarship, I learned from him. You know, how to carefully read a text, to look for what has been missed in the text. I also learned from him how to laugh when a text is funny.
Yeah, that's what you say about Rav Dimitrovsky and Shaul Lieberman, is that both of them are huge Talmid Chachamim, but also in the way of living, you learned a lot from them.
Exactly.
How they are mensch.
Exactly.
That makes also a Talmid Chacham. That's part of a Talmid
Exactly.
Chacham.
And I am always quoting stories or quoting something that they said 50 years ago. I, you know, I'm remembering, and I remember when they said it. In addition to them, I studied with Avram Yehoshua Heschel. You know, he was not quite as important to me as because I went more in the very much in my spirit more in the Litvish than in the Chassid, but still also a giant, a giant of, aside from his learning and his Torah, of ethics, you know, of what it means to be a from Jew walking next to Martin Luther King. That had also a profound impact on me. It was this magical place, the Jewish Theological Seminary. It was the my teachers were the last generation of the teachers there who had been trained in Europe before the war,
before the Churban,
before the Churban, exactly.
So you had the Nitzotzot from
it's
this.
Really, this feeling of
The art of quoting is something very important in your books.
Yeah.
Ha-mevi davar b'shem amocho, mevi geula le'olam, right?
Right.
What does quoting have to do with the geula? Why is it so important?
Well, first of all, on a very simple level, it makes the words not theft. You know, if you don't quote, but there's something else that's very important. You know, I was mentioned in a movie.
Right. Footnotes.
Footnote is the name of the movie, right? And this whole, so people think, you know, that's sort of the, what should I call it, the trope, the topos, is that scholars put in footnotes to shore up their writing, to show how learned they are, and this supports, and this supports, and this supports, and, you know, it's a kind of, it's Punktverkehr, the exact opposite. When I write a footnote, I am saying to my reader, here, look at this text, I'm quoting it from there. You can go see whether I'm right in my understanding or I'm wrong. Right? In other words, so the footnote is the mark of vulnerability, of the place where the possibility of being challenged
begins.
Recently, I read a book by quite a fine scholar, whom I think quite highly of. And I read her new book, and she has no footnotes. She quotes texts. She say, as the Talmud says, you know, as we find in Josephus.
So you can't check.
You can't check. And that is the mode of mastery. Right? That is, believe me, just believe me, here it is. Whereas the mode of quotation is the one that opens up conversation.
More generally, you say in this book with the Clémence Boulouk, Une vie dans le Talmud, which is an interview book, you say that speaking means quoting, that we all live with a concordance in our mind.
That's even a very significant point.
Mm.
Yeah. The way that linguistics has portrayed language, they think that we have a lexicon, that the language has a lexicon, and that's what we carry in our heads, words with meanings. I don't think so. I think what we have in our head is a settled custom, an enormous box full of quotations, right?
Where from?
From everything we've read, everything we've heard. That's why the native speaker of a language always has more access to the language than even someone who has studied that language.
In a PhD.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because it's the phrases that you heard as a child, the things that you read when, you know, for decades, so that whenever we use a word, we are essentially drawing from every time we've heard it before. This is a restatement of Bakhtin's later, Kristeva's idea of intertextuality.
Julia Kristeva?
Yeah, Julia Kristeva, yeah. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, nowadays, for most academic writers, intertextuality has become simply a fancy way of saying allusion.
Mm.
You know, anything sounds better if you use a French word, right? You know. But it's much more profound than that. It is that that set of associations and usages. I've sometimes thought about writing something, but I don't think I have time to write everything I want to write about Wittgenstein and Bakhtin, whom I think both of them essentially get to the same notion, that language is not words and definitions, but usage.
Are you scared of what's happening now with this language revolution with artificial intelligence?
I am terrified with artificial intelligence, yes.
What's happening?
Well, one thing that's happening is a lot of junk. There's just simply a lot of junk, and it looks like very authoritative junk. I was in New York in September, and I wanted to make a date for somebody in October in Berkeley after Shabbos, right? So I needed to know when Shabbos ends. So I asked my computer, when does Shabbos end on October 5th in Berkeley, California? And AI told me, at sunset. Which, first of all,
is wrong,
and secondly, even if it were right, it wouldn't. Even if they said, 40 minutes after sunset, I'd say it would have been absolutely useless, right? So, and that is such a simple thing.
Is AI a danger for what language means?
It's a danger for what thinking means, mm-hmm. you know. At least now, all of the AI, all of the chat things have kind of a, they come with a user's warning. This program makes mistakes.
Right.
You know. But, you know, I am not interested in AI for anything more complicated than to tell me how to take the bus mm-hmm. from Montmartre to Montparnasse or something of that sort.
We talked about your models.
Yeah.
Your Rabbeinim.
Yeah.
There's one model for you too. You speak about that in the introduction to Unheroic Conduct. It's a woman. It's Bertha Pappenheim.
Yes.
What does she represent for you?
For one thing, a political activist, an activist for social justice, not just for Jews, but for women in particular, who was a Shomer Shabbos her whole life. You know? She was a religious Jew. And most people who wrote about her had somehow missed that point completely. And one of her big critiques, sharp critiques of Orthodoxy, as it was then, was that it was driving women away.
Mm.
And the reform movement was, the product of that. So that was for me a very, moving.
So it's a critic from inside.
Yes, a critic from inside, right, exactly, who has been misread as a critic from outside.
Outside, right.
Mm. You know, say, she didn't go to university. Yeah. And so what university should she have gone to? Barnard College for women? You know, the women were, there was no universities for women.
They were not allowed to.
Right, they were not allowed to. So the fact that she was Orthodox, they would say, oh, she came from an Orthodox family, they didn't let her go to college.
There's nothing to do.
You know, exactly. You know, so it was part of my kind of apologetic project also was, you know, to, and of course she was also Freud's Anna-O. So that discovery, which was only, became known in the 1950s. That Anna O was
Bertha
Pappenheim, you know. So
there would not have been any psychoanalysis without her, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah. So I found her in that way also a very, very appealing, complex figure. The piece I wrote about her was called Anna O.
Mm-hmm.
Orthodox, Orthodox, right?
So. Let me ask you I wanted to ask you a last question.
Yes.
You live in the margins, right? And you say you don't feel comfortable in you don't really find a synagogue where you live in the USA, mm-hmm. you don't go too much to Israel anymore. Does that make you sad?
Yes. Yes, it makes me very sad. And I'm always in searching of a place to daven where I will feel at home. And um, I was actually very happy in this Chabad stable because it's a very warm place and the,
in Berkeley
and the shaluach there is explicitly not, you know, some Chabad places are horrible from that point of view. But that kind of broke for me on Purim. Mm. So I'm not saying I won't daven there anymore, but I don't have the same sense of be'ami ani yosef.
But don't you tell yourself sometimes you should be less radical,
no.
Less strict?
No.
You're right to...
I have to do what I have to do. Jews got to do what a Jew's got to do. You know, that's... I hope that when I come to the gates of the next world, if there is a next world...
To the Eibishter.
Yeah. And they say, okay, what right do you have to come in? I'll say, I told the truth. So.
Toda rabba.
Toda lecha.
Daniel Boyarin. Le livre s'appelle Judaïsme, la généalogie d'une notion moderne. Et puis, il faut se plonger dans toute l'œuvre de Daniel Boyarin en français comme en anglais. Merci à vous pour votre fidélité.